Welcome back to the Our Voices podcast feed. I'm Aaron White. This interview with Florida congressional candidate Jen Perlman is the latest in an installment of interviews in our series with down-ballot candidates running on progressive economic platforms that challenge the establishment policy agenda of the Democratic Party in D.C. To hear more of these interviews and our documentary podcasts on the U.S. election, head over to opendemocracy.net/our economy. Jen Perlman is a candidate running in Florida's 23rd congressional district. Backed by former presidential candidates Andrew Yang and Marion Williamson, Jen endorses a $2,000 a month universal basic income, as well as Medicare for All and a Green New Deal. We began by asking Jen to describe her background and why she is challenging the current Democratic representative, Debbie Wasserman Schultz.
My name is Jen Perlman. I am a second generation native Floridian, so I actually grew up down here. And I went to school, I left in 88, went and studied journalism. So my background is actually journalism and then marketing, and then I went to law school. And following law school, I did criminal defense, and that is really one of my primary interests and one of our primary positions is criminal defense reform or criminal justice reform. And then I moved back to South Florida in 2003 with my husband and one kid, and now two kids later. So I went back to, I got my license reinstated about a year and a half ago. I took 10 years off to be home with my boys. So I've been doing criminal justice advocacy. I am involved in helping returning citizens. Oh, I hate that term. Previously incarcerated individuals get their right restored to vote. That has been a big issue here in the past year. And so I come at this with a journalism, marketing, law background. I've always been involved in politics. I've volunteered on every campaign since before I was 18, presidential campaign. So I've always been involved and I've always been very policy oriented. But really, this was more of a timing issue in terms of in 2018, we saw that there were several non-corporatists that were able to get through and get into Congress. So really, this is a campaign about getting the corporate money out and just speaking for regular people.
Great. And could you talk a little bit about your opponent, Debbie Wasserman Schultz? She was the chair of the DNC in 2016, infamously, and why you're challenging her.
She is a career politician. Debbie came right out of school and went right into the Florida legislature. So combined between Florida and congressional representation, she's been representing this area for 28 years and in Congress for 16. So everybody knows her from the 2016 DNC fiasco. She had to resign. They were cheating Bernie. I mean, everyone around the country knows that, but really, she's just extremely corporate and special interest owned. And if you look at who she sides with and how she votes and her positions, she's really more of a pro-choice Republican than a Democrat in many ways. She's extremely hawkish. She in fact, was one of 30 Democrats that just last week voted to give Trump an increase of $50 billion to his Department of Homeland Security. She just voted to not cut the Pentagon budget by just 10%. And she just voted not to bring home our troops from Afghanistan. So she is generally corporate owned and does things that are more in line with the military industrial complex and the fossil fuel industry and big pharma than she actually represents regular people. So really what this is about is it's not some left wing radical situation here. 72% of people want Medicare for all. That includes Republicans. So if she's not doing what the majority of people want, then it's time for somebody to do what the majority of people want. And that's really what this is about.
This dynamic of the race where you have, obviously, you're campaigning without taking corporate PAC money. She's someone who's been in Washington for a long time and takes big donations, we know, from big pharma, et cetera, and the private insurance industry. But this dynamic is something that has played out in many races over the last couple of years, most notably, obviously, in 2018 with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. This time around, we've seen Cori Bush very recently, and obviously Jamal Bowman in New York. So I wondered if I could get your view on how those races have had, how they've inspired you, and how yours might be similar or different.
AOC's race in 18 is extremely similar to what I'm dealing with right now. We have a very long-term incumbent that's just sitting there very comfortably in a very gerrymandered blue district. We have closed primaries. It's hard to get out the incumbent. And so, yeah, that 18 was a big year, noticing the non-corporatists get through. And as for Corey and Jamal, those are my BNC slate mates. And so I am very excited that they, like, to me, with people like Corey and Jamal in Congress, regardless of what happens in my race, the world is an infinitely better place now. That is what I can say. Cori Bush in Congress makes the world an infinitely better place. So, yeah, I find her inspiring in general, just, and I actually know her. But yeah, it's all inspiring. It's momentum.
And what have you learned about organizing during a pandemic? Obviously, now you can't go and knock on doors. Has this impacted your race? And do you think that this bold progressive agenda can be electorally more durable in a sense with the crisis that we're facing?
We see both sides of that. So we actually are socially distant canvassing. We're wearing masks. We're handing out sanitizers. And we have been canvassing, which is really the bread and butter of any grassroots campaign. And we did lose a chunk of time when this first started and when everything was shut down. But we also have an advantage being that our audience and our supporters, we do tend to have a younger generation of supporters. And that really lends itself very much so to social media. Whereas somebody like Debbie, her social media following is almost non-existent. You know, most of her followers don't ever really look at anything. So she'll have a ton of followers, but then if you look at how many views or likes, it's like, it's nothing. So, you know, I do think we've had that social media advantage, and COVID has been somewhat challenging. But I have learned, you know, honestly, the best part of this campaign, and it continues to be the best part of this campaign, is that we are a service campaign. We've been a service campaign almost the entire time that I've had any volunteers on board. Once we started having other people come on board, we've always been treating this as service long before COVID. And so we're still doing those things and building coalitions and really trying to reach in vulnerable communities in so many different ways. I've spent a huge part of this shutdown doing live streams where I get to be the journalist and I get to interview guests. And I have had to, I pick out anybody that I want to learn something about, then I invite them on. So I've had somebody about nuclear energy. I had somebody recently about urban agriculture. I've had somebody on about how the Everglades is actually supposed to flow naturally, like just different things that I'm trying to learn. So I've really been using this campaign as information gathering and service giving, which to me is what it's supposed to be anyway. But those things are not really too impacted by COVID. It definitely could impact our election for sure. But we don't know. We've been encouraging vote by mail all along anyway. So we'll see what happens.
So you say you've been collecting a lot of that information, and obviously you have a very comprehensive policy platform. We're in a moment right now where there's 30 million people collecting jobless benefits. We have an eviction crisis, Congress stalling over renewing relief packages. So I wondered if you could give us very briefly what you would be advocating for as your priorities in this crisis at the moment.
Let me be very clear that my number one priority has always been and will be Medicare for all. Okay, so that's been my priority long before there was a COVID pandemic. But I do think that with this unemployment crisis that we're facing, it's become even more clear that maybe healthcare and employment should not be tied together. That's just a failing system. It's a failing system. So on the one hand, it's devastating. And on the other hand, it's waking people up in terms of how frail our system actually is. Of all the developed nations in the world, we are the least equipped to deal with a pandemic, the least equipped. Lack of healthcare, lack of paid sick leave, lack of, you know, any sort of social safety net for people. We have, and Florida is exponentially worse. So if unemployment is bad in the country, it's exponentially going to be worse in Florida. It is going to be devastating. And as soon as the evictions start, we're going to start seeing shanty towns all over the place. They're going to be all over the place. And right now they're telling that they want the kids to go back to school. I can't even fathom how people are going to be functioning with this pandemic right now, and we have nobody taking any leadership position whatsoever. So automatically, we needed to nationalize a couple of different things temporarily under emergency basis. We needed to be doing payroll protection, not unemployment benefits. Even if we only did 80% or whatever, I forget which country, it might have been UK or Germany, somebody was doing 80% of the payroll. I mean, even something like that where we would keep workers furloughed instead of having people unemployed would be infinitely better for us to recoup in the long term. And then add on top of that, we have no universal basic income, period. And now we're in a crisis and we got a one-time payment of $1,200. That is, it's a joke. Meanwhile, the corporations got like a $3 trillion slush fund to bail themselves out yet again, where that money does not come down. Whereas if you invest in regular people, that money trickles up. We have no consumers right now. And so when people start saying things like UBI is communist or socialist, I've been called a lot of names. The reality is it's ultimately pro-capitalist, because you cannot have a capitalist economy without consumers. It doesn't exist. So what will eventually happen if we keep going the way we are without anybody having disposable income is the very, very, very rich people, your Jeff Bezos, your Mark Zuckerbergs of the world, they're fine. They don't rely on income at this point. They're just this self-feeding machine. But anybody even one step below that, anybody whose income relies on consumerism of any sort, even if you're at the very high of an income earner, you're relying on consumerism, those are going to implode. And that is to me the ultimate killing of capitalism. So to me, everybody needs a social safety net so we can breathe. And then everybody needs to be able to have income so that we can spend. We are a completely consumer-based economy. We cannot function without consumers. So UBI would be the first thing I would have done in this pandemic. But of course, in my universe, we had Medicare for All and paid sick leave in the first place. So it would have all been sort of kept better under control.
In an upcoming documentary podcast, we're going to be focusing on education and particularly how decades of disinvestment from public education have made it right now uniquely difficult to actually safely reopen schools. What do you think needs to be done to safely reopen schools? And do you see this happening in Florida?
I do not see schools being able to reopen safely because, quite honestly, Florida never properly shut down in the first place. So, and this is, I mean, we could argue back and forth as to what could have, should have, would have been done in the beginning of this. But at this point in time, we are seeing increasing numbers. So we're clearly on an incline of COVID cases. So the fact that they're talking about reopening schools is hilarious. Meanwhile, if you don't open schools, then working parents can't go back to work, even though their work shouldn't be requiring them to go back to work. But that gets to, this is where you see the connection, the interrelatedness of crushing labor and screwing the kids at their education at the same time. So if it were safe for everybody to go back, then fine. But we know it isn't. We see increasing numbers. Science says it's not safe. So I tend to side with reason and science. That's one of the things about me. I generally am very reasonable. So no, I do not think schools should be reopening. I think that we have been underfunding and defunding our schools. People want to complain about defunding the police. I tell them it's kind of like how we treat education. We'll just defund it kind of like that. We'll just pass the money off to other people and that's that. Really, education needs to be federally subsidized across the board. We need to come up with this plan as to what we all find a suitable level of education, and then we need to make sure that that's equitably applied everywhere. So if we say, I do believe the teachers should all be getting, I mean, I believe Bernie's plan is calling for a $60,000 minimum salary, annual salary for teachers. I still find that kind of low, but, you know, so be it. But we need to have a system where every student, whether you're in the middle of nowhere, Mississippi, or you're in Manhattan, has the exact same quality of education available through our public system. So certain schools require more subsidization than other schools. So I'm not calling it equality, it's equity. You know, schools that already are at a great advantage or maybe have a computer for every student, they don't need the same amount of money that a school that doesn't have that has. So it isn't about everybody getting the same. It's about everybody being brought to a level that we all decide as a society is how we want to educate our children. That's a separate discussion. That's more, I think we should be looking at Finland or, you know, someplace like that. But financially speaking, The federal government needs to be subsidizing public education so that all states and all municipalities are as equitable as possible. And yeah, I'm not talking in terms of curriculum, mind you. That's a you know, more of a state thing. But really just in terms of the quality of the infrastructure and the funding and teacher salaries, it needs to be equitable.
A lot of people listening to this podcast will be listening internationally. Obviously, I'm here based in the UK, and Open Democracy has an international audience. So we wondered if you could tell us a bit about how you see voter attitudes changing in Florida more broadly at the moment. Obviously, it is generally a swing state. It's fundamental to winning the presidential election, which is coming up in November. I wondered how what Trump's attitude towards the coronavirus has been and how that impact has gone down in Florida, but also the local governor, Ron DeSantis.
Ron DeSantis is essentially mini Trump. He was put in that position, as far as I'm concerned, to ensure that Florida goes for Trump this year. I really believe that that is why somebody like DeSantis was placed in that position. So he essentially just mirrors Trump. So whatever you see Trump doing on the national level, we're getting that in Florida on the micro level from our governor. It's almost like they live in this delusional universe where they're walking around talking about that everything is fine. It's really the emperor has no clothes, and they're walking around like everything's fine and yet not really doing anything. So Florida never properly shut down, that first and foremost. So instead of shutting down and spending that time building up the infrastructure, which is what the whole point of flattening the curve was to make sure that you have the resources in place as those cases start coming in when you do open back up. So we didn't do that. We weren't building up our beds, our ventilators, we weren't doing any of that. We didn't do any of that. So really, we are nowhere different now than we were in March, except for now there's more cases and a lot of unemployed people for nothing. We would have probably been in the same position if absolutely nothing had been done from March. So I would say that we are seeing it heavy in Florida. We generally see things exponentially greater for a lot of reasons. Our wealth inequality is at the top of the national, you know, index. Our housing crisis is at the top of the national index. So all of the things that affect this country are going to exponentially hit the places that have the widest wealth inequality gaps and the biggest housing problems already. So Florida is going to be, I mean, we're looking at a gargantuan disaster here.
And how have you seen that impact the voter preferences? How do you think that's going to impact the electorate before November?
Yeah, it's hard. You know what? It's really hard to say. On the one hand, we see this complete anti-Trump. He's completely failed us. There's all the Trump haters. But then when I'm canvassing, I see a lot of Trump flags. I see a lot of Trump signs. And so it's really hard to know what's going to come into play more. So on the one hand, we have people that don't like Trump, right? But we also know that the enthusiasm percentages regarding Joe Biden are much lower than Trump's. So Biden might be higher in polls, but Trump has greater enthusiasm from his supporters. So will this pandemic slow people down from voting? You know, people still have until the 8th to request a vote by mail. So I really don't know. It's like campaigning 101 in a pandemic has not been written yet. So it's very, I definitely see people are more desperate. Are they blaming Trump more? Seemingly, but I don't know that that's going to necessarily force them to come out and vote as much as the Trump supporters will come out and vote. So we'll see.
One thing that you talked a lot about just recently was the housing crisis, in your previous answer, in Florida, but also nationwide. And the eviction moratorium recently expired that Congress passed. I'm wondering what's your plan for guaranteeing affordable housing to all Americans? I know some people want to increase Section 8 funding, then others advocate for building what's been noted as a Green New Deal for public housing and building a lot of public units of housing. So what's your take on that?
I say yes and yes. I am of the belief that you do everything from all the different possible angles. There's no one solution to this. And that's where I think people get caught up is arguing this is the better way, that's the better way. I'm more of the idea of that looks good. Let's try that. And I think that what we need to do is look at models that have worked in other places. And we know none of this is rocket science. This is what's so interesting to me. We can look at places that have successfully done things like having affordable housing, having less homelessness, having a better jobs program, having Medicare. Like these are not rocket science concepts. So I definitely believe that we need to have a subsidized housing situation for people. It's when you look at a system that has lots of empty units, lots of available empty housing, and also simultaneously has lots of homeless people, that's a failure. So what we're seeing is overdevelopment for the wealthy and not anywhere for the people to live who can't afford to live in those places. So this comes in the form of when you're giving tax breaks, you're giving credits, you're giving subsidies to developers, and you're using – basically how we work is you use sticks and carrots financially to get people to do what you want them to do. You want to build a billion-dollar, you know, development of housing, that's fine, but you're also going to have to build this amount of these units, and you're going to have to provide this amount of recourse to the ecology that you're destroying, and you have to compensate that community for what you're building. And I think that is where you have really the most power, is to really leverage over what developers do and don't do. And yes, I do think you can control this. You want to build a shopping mall? That's great. Build a shopping mall. But you also have to build this, this, and this to serve this level of the community. And we're seeing, instead of that, we're seeing complete gentrification. In any desirable area that has been built up, we're seeing it gentrified. And again, that's one of those things where Florida will be exponentially worse than other places. So we cannot allow wealthy developers to dictate who gets to live where based on, well, they like that view, so nobody else can live here. That doesn't work. This is where we see the complete control of our legislators by our corporations. Because if you weren't bought and paid for by these developers, then this would just be the common sense, humane thing to just do. You would say, well, we need to have housing that everybody can afford in different ways and different styles. But we're not going to see that because these people have no incentive to do that. They're allowed to just run amok. There's absolutely no regulation or control over development in this state. Like, it's out of control. They keep building and building. They keep destroying the environment. They're not providing housing for everybody. And yet we keep rewarding that behavior. So to me, we need to stop rewarding the bad behavior. And we're not seeing that.
So that housing policy platform that you just outlined, along with your argument for Medicare for All and decommodifying education, these line up with some of the people we mentioned earlier, like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Jamal Bowman. But both of those people have previously identified themselves as socialist. You clearly are not a socialist. Well, at least correct me if you're wrong, but you're not, from what I've heard of your answer before about propping up capitalism. So I wondered whether, firstly, whether or not you think it's completely unelectable to run as a socialist in Florida, but then secondly, how you distinguish yourself from those people who do identify themselves as socialist.
Let me preface this by saying that from Bernie Sanders to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, I find that they've all improperly used the term socialist. None of them, they are not democratic socialists. They're social democrats. And Bernie was never a democratic socialist. And I always feared that when he used that term, it would scare people off. And the problem with that is if he were legitimately a socialist, then you own it and you wear it like a badge. That's fine. But when you're not a socialist and you're using that term and it's just scaring people off, to me, that's counterproductive. I identify as a social democrat. I have no problem with capitalism. It has to be controlled. And there are certain industries that need to be taken off the table. Healthcare, public education, and corrections are not to be for-profit industries. So I believe you can have a capitalist economy while still preserving certain industries for the welfare of the collective, and those need to be protected. So, you know, if somebody invents a widget and they want to sell some unnecessary widget and rip you guys off left and right like a fidget spinner, or, you know, whatever those things are, and they want to rip people off for the fidgets, have at it. Have at it. You want to make 1,000% markup on your whatever it is that you're selling and you find consumers that want to buy it, I have no problem with that. But there are certain industries that cannot be for profit in a civilized society. And so to me, if we take certain industries off the table as for profit, then you don't have the predatory nature of capitalism to worry about. Then you're just talking about, I don't think that every working place should be owned by the workers necessarily, but I think all workers need to be treated fairly and have a level of dignity and respect. Anybody working a 40-hour work week should be able to live. So that's not socialism. That's decency. And so I'm not talking about workers all owning the means of all production. I don't agree with that. In some cases, worker co-ops make a lot of sense. In some cases, they don't. But if somebody wants to be a billionaire and they can rightfully do so, treating their workers fairly, paying their fair share of taxes, and not screwing our environment, have at it, man. I personally don't think it's possible. I don't think you can properly earn $1 billion. I think you steal $1 billion. And it's not because I'm a socialist. It's because they're screwing their workers. You can treat your workers fairly without being socialist. That's where the government comes into play and monitors a capitalistic system with regulations. But everybody needs a living wage. Everybody needs health care not tied to employment. Everybody needs decency. And so that's not socialist. Socialism is when the workers own the means of production. I tell people this all the time because they misuse the word.
Right. So my follow up to that would be, I would tend to agree with you that Bernie Sanders' platform in particular would tend to be more of a social democratic platform, particularly from a European perspective. Why then do you believe that they have identified as socialist?
I honestly think, and this is might be very, very naive of me, and maybe there was more of a plot about it, but to me, I think that Bernie just improperly used that phrase when he first started saying that, and there is a lot of confusion as to the difference between what a democratic socialist is versus a social democrat, and even if you look them up, but they are different. And so I honestly just think that Bernie just improperly used that term in the very beginning, and then everybody sort of jumped on that. Because really, all of the people of whom you're speaking, none of them are socialists. And interestingly, I do know a lot of socialists. I am very involved with DSA down here. And a lot of those are people that work on my campaign because they obviously agree with me on many issues. So I do know a lot of socialists. And Bernie and AOC are not socialists. So I really just think he just improperly used the phrase.
You're saying now that you work with a lot of DSA members down in Florida, you're clearly not worried about the term socialism scaring off voters in Florida. Is that a fair thing to say?
Well, if I were coming out and saying I'm a socialist, then yeah, that wouldn't go over well. We have a very significant older population. And this is a very generational thing that we're seeing right now with the terminology of stuff. And especially down here with an older Latino population, you've got the Cuban population. Now, granted, a lot of those people are Republicans, and so they're not really voting in my primary anyway. But just in general, there is such an incendiary correlation with the term socialism that I wouldn't. But as far as me working with people that are socialists, no, I have no problem with that because we agree on a lot of policies. If you're a socialist, you support Medicare for all. I'm a socialist. I'm not a socialist, but I support Medicare for all. So why would I not want to work with the people on the issues that we agree on the most? So I also work with the Southwest Broward Republican Organization. I have no problem. I met them at a protest against drilling in the Everglades and became friends with one of the people in that organization. And so they also agree about term limits and election integrity. So I'll work with anybody who wants to get stuff done.
Just lastly here, you've received the endorsements of Marianne Williamson and Andrew Yang, and I think they are some of the most interesting figures that were in the Democratic primary, especially their ability to last so long and appear on the debate stage. I'm wondering if you can talk about a bit of the dynamic that you think that they represent and their importance in the race that we saw.
I'm so glad you asked that because nobody else has asked me that question. I generally will get asked about like group endorsements, but I am beyond proud of this because I am the only BNC candidate that has been endorsed by both Marianne and Andrew Yang. And to me, what it says is that it validates everything that I think and feel about what I was just saying in terms of coming together with people on issues that you do agree with to get things done. And it really shows you that reasonable people who are not corporate owned can come together and come to agreements and work on things that matter, regardless of what your whole own purist philosophy is. So the fact that Andrew Yang endorsed me speaks volumes. I don't agree with him on every policy. He doesn't agree with me on every policy. And yet when I spoke with him on the phone, and I've spoken with him a couple of times, he is so bright and so reasonable and so just in this for the right reasons. And it's similar for Marianne. It's a similar vibe. It's that it's not about the career for them. They're really in this to bring a particular message. And the reason that they both lasted as long as they did, quite honestly, is that they were bringing something new to the party. And I don't mean the political party. I mean the figuratively, like, fun party, right? They were bringing something new to the game. And you don't see that. You had a whole bunch of centrists that all stood for the exact same thing. And then you had Andrew Yang that brought UBI to the forefront in the same way that Bernie brought Medicare for All. That's bringing something new to the party. And I will anybody who is standing up with a vision and that is something that is new and different, that needs to be embraced. Both of those individuals were, to me, were the only people really that were doing that in a way. I mean, Tulsi to some extent had that effect in terms of talking about the regime change wars. Her anti-war message, I think, was a really good platform position. But really, when you talk about those are the only three people, by the way, other than Bernie, that I would have supported for that exact reason. That it wasn't about party, it wasn't about some purist ideology, it was about common sense, humanity, and reason. And that, to me, speaks way more volumes than just getting in line behind whatever your group says you're supposed to believe. And I just respect them both so, like, I respect both of them so immensely. Like, that was a really big deal to me to get those endorsements.
I think they really did add a very unique dynamic and demonstrated a very kind of an underbelly of what's going on in American society right now, especially Marianne Williamson with a more kind of spiritual lens and angle at our current situation.
And they both represent different parts of me. Like, it's the most perfect combination, because Marianne is truly the only person I saw in that entire race that really understands the nature of the collective and what it means is to be a collective. And yes, when I say that, there will be people saying, we're not a collective, we're not communist. You'll get those comments. But I'm talking about, like, the spiritual collective, how the interconnectedness of everything. And she really gets that in a way that nobody else gets that. And that I love about her. And Andrew is somebody who so really foresees where we're going in terms of the future of what is our economy going to look like? What is automation going to look like? Like, he really sees this practical, how can we fix this problem, and doing so based on reason. And so I really, they're both amazing. Like, I really love both of, and maybe if they had melded together, it'd be like the one perfect candidate, you know. But yeah, I just think that that's really important to see both of those angles of things.
So I'll just ask you a really final question, if that's okay. Today is the 6th of August. It's the 75th anniversary of the nuclear bomb dropped on Hiroshima. And I know that you have a very strong platform on dismantling the military industrial complex and preventing the manufacture of nuclear weapons. I'd like you maybe to speak a little bit about that, why you think it's so important. And I'd also maybe mention the fact that Joe Biden, who is now the Democratic nominee, has moved to the progressive left on a lot of issues. But dismantling the military or talking about critiques that come from the left is not something that he seems to have shifted on. Do you believe that once you enter Congress, that this will be an issue that you can bring to the forefront and actually make some movement on?
I can tell you that it is something I will never be quiet about. I can tell you that I would have not ever in a million years been one of the people voting against reducing the Pentagon budget by 10%. You're never going to hear this from any of them. The military-industrial complex and the fossil fuel industry, which are also, I think, the worst threats to our environment, control everything here. This is what we live to militarize and imperialize the world. That's what we're about. Hiroshima, that's a war crime. I don't even want to go in terms of, like, my personal feelings on all of the warmongering and all of that stuff. So we could just stick with the fact that right now we're in, what, 8 illegal wars. Congress needs to reclaim its power over over war. And we've just basically been giving the executive branch. And by the way, this was long before Trump. This has been going on since the original authorization of use of military force, which I believe is unconstitutional. I digress. So that all needs to be reined in. Congress sits there, even the Democrats sit there, and on the one hand, they criticize Trump. He's a madman. He's doing all this stuff. Okay, well, let's give him some more money for his military budget. Let's sign off on all of these ridiculous things while pretending to actually be the resistance. I call them MIC resistance. So with someone like me, there's no MIC resistance. It's just resistance. And it's not going to necessarily get anywhere because there's not enough of me, unfortunately. There's not enough people that are not going to be beholden yet to the military-industrial complex. But no, I'll never stop talking about this. I will never stop griping about us bombing people all around the world. And it's just never going to, I'm never going to stop about this. This has been bothering me forever. I am vehemently opposed to most of what we do overseas. Most, by far. And, you know, when you look at somebody like my opponent, she's voted for every military action since she's been in Congress. She's one of the biggest war hawks I think the Democrats even have on their team. So, I mean, I cannot see, personally, finding anything redeemable about any of these interventions that we're doing right now, whether it's sanctions against Venezuela, sanctions in Iran, which are war crimes, bombing Hiroshima, that was another war crime. We're just basically the world bullies. We're the world bullies. And I'm never going to stand for that, and I'm never going to agree to that, and I find it abhorrent.
I think that's a really fantastic note to end on. That's been a truly fascinating interview. Jen Perlman, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Thank you for listening to this Our Voices podcast from Open Democracy. If you enjoyed this podcast and would encourage others to listen, head to iTunes, subscribe, and leave us a review. Open Democracy is an independent global media platform that is only possible because of your kind donations. To find out more or to make a donation, head to opendemocracy.net.